you probably noticed this week, the readings have been a little bit longer. We had 18 pages for this particular week, and the great majority of that was Scripture itself. So some of you may have found that it would take a little bit longer to be reading in this last week than it has in the previous week. Well, there's Neville, so it's good to see you guys. Tonight we've got more of just the biblical information to be reviewing. And of course, we're also in the last chapters of the book of Genesis. And so tonight, and for the last time, I think, I just want to run through quickly several slides, if you'll direct your attention up here, and look at just simple outlines of the book of Genesis. By this time, we've now had four readings in Genesis, and I've been giving you these outlines again and again. And so hopefully, you know, it's starting to settle a little bit for us that God had a plan that is fairly readily identifiable in this book. There's 50 chapters. There's an awful lot of information, but it can be boiled down pretty easily. So for tonight, we'll be looking at chapters 37 through 50. But first, as a very basic outline, the first 11 chapters have these three things that we study. And one of them, the story of Babel, is really only even half a chapter. So that was not very long, but we have creation, we have the story of Noah and the flood, and then the changing of the languages. Then we have chapters 12 through 24. So we had a group of 11. Now we've got 13 chapters, which is pretty well balanced, about the same amount of material, but it all revolves around whom? Just one man. That's Abraham. So over 13 chapters, we find out about God's choosing this man. We find out about God's promises to this man. We find out about his own sort of personal exodus, where the man comes over the Fertile Crescent, over 1,000 miles, and comes down into his promised land of Palestine. He has one adventure after another. And so 13 chapters, just in Genesis, are all devoted to Abraham. Then we came to Jacob, and you'll notice it's pretty much the same amount of material, 12 chapters as opposed to 13, but in chapters 25 through 36, these chapters revolve around that man, his family, his promise from God, and his adventures. And in the reading that we just had in for this week, who is the central player? Well, now it's Joseph, and we repeat that cycle again. He is the next in line with these promises. He is one who figures highly in world history with his impact over the Egyptian kingdom. And so we're going to have 14 chapters that are devoted to Joseph. These are different. We have, for instance, his deathbed blessings upon his sons, which you don't find with Jacob or Abraham like that. Very different kind of material. But nonetheless, when you look at the outline of Genesis, with really only a couple of exceptions being creation and the Tower of Babel story, you're really dealing with how many people? There's four people who were the principal players in Genesis. They are Noah, Abraham, Jacob, and Joseph. They've got all kinds of family members and other ties, you know, and happenstances, but effectively, God is giving us information about these four individuals. Now, going into some more detail with the first 24 chapters, this is from 2 weeks ago. Chapters 1 through 3 is creation, 4 and 5 are Adam's descendants, 6 through 9 are Noah and the flood, chapter 10 is Noah's descendants, 11, the first part, is the Tower of Babel, second part is Shem's descendants, and then chapters 12 through 24, 13 chapters, all dealing with Abraham. When you lay it out like this, the first half of Genesis, what word do you see repeating, and what then do you realize God's been spending a lot of time on this? What's he doing here in these chapters? It's not just the story of these men, but it's the story of those men as figureheads, and then their descendants. We are seeing chains of people. God is establishing a lineage. He has purposes in these lineages. And so in these early chapters, a tremendous amount of time is just spent telling lists, or giving us lists, of these various descendants. Ultimately, these genealogies are going to bear what fruit 2,000 years later? Jesus the Christ is coming. Jesus is coming through these people. And so we have been tracing the lineage of a particular group separated for God's particular purposes, and through whom ultimately the promises that are not just to that race, but to all the world, will be fulfilled in Jesus the Christ. And when they are, then will genealogies be so important anymore? Once Jesus comes and fulfills all the prophecies that involve these descendants, when he comes from that lineage, then does it matter what tribe you're from? What tribe are you from? Unless you're a Jew, you're from no tribe. And if you are a Jew, you're still from no tribe, because there's no way to know what tribe you could possibly be from. I've said so many times, next time you meet somebody who says they're a Jew, just, you know, say, wow, that is so interesting to me. Which tribe are you? And then watch the fun. Because by biblical definition, what is the only definition for a Jew? They are direct descendants of Abraham. Can anybody claim to be a Jew today based on a biblical record? No. The genealogies were destroyed in 70 AD, again in 130, in the Bar Kokhba revolt, and so thoroughly decimated that you could never know, the Levites, for instance, to have the old temple service and all that, because there's no way to know who would come from the tribe of Levi to be a priest. So, okay, in the outline, God is telling us everything from the creation of the universe in the first 24 chapters down through this man Abraham, who is the big pivot point, because starting with him, Jews are separated from Gentiles. Then, Jacob's outline, we'll go very quickly, we did this in the reading last week, begins in chapter 25 with Ishmael and Isaac's sons, these two sons, would be the grandsons of Jacob. Isaac, claiming that his wife's his sister, twice Abraham had done that. Chapter 27, he steals the blessing. Chapter 28, though, he receives the promise from God. Chapter 29, we have all of the, the political fall revolving around the marriage of Rachel and Leah to Jacob, and Laban's shenanigans and cheating him time and time again, which, of course, results both in Jacob's having some children, but also needing to get out of town. So he's fleeing from Laban, and quite an interesting story there. His name is changed to Israel in chapter 33 in a marvelously wise way of making peace with his brother. Jacob and Esau are reconciled. In chapter 34, Dinah is raped, one of the ugliest stories in all the Bible there. It's just a disturbingly awful thing. Chapter 35, a second time, though, Jacob receives his promise from God. In chapter 36, we get these descendants again, but this time, these descendants of Esau's, will they be in this lineage for the coming Christ? No. And they are the Arabic peoples, Arabian peoples, as we would call them today. This is where they have come from. So, Jacob's outline, a lot of intrigue, a lot of sin, the terrible, misbehavior that goes on. So we used that term last week, warts and all. The Bible telling us the truth about these people. Not glossing it over, not idealizing them, but explaining to us, sometimes in just terrible detail, how they can be very, very sinful. But were they chosen to be God's special people because they were so sinless? Because they were so much smarter than anybody else? No, because they were wealthier, prettier, faster, jumped higher. No, nothing. They were chosen by God's sovereign decision so that he could use them as examples to the world, and through whom then the Christ would come. Now, looking ahead to the reading that we'll be talking about tonight, in Joseph's side of this story, chapter 37, he will have the first of his visions, and as a result, be sold into slavery. Chapter 38, Judah is not going to treat his daughter-in-law very well, to say the very least. And then in chapter 39, Joseph's going to find himself a slave in Egypt in the household of a rather high official by the name of Potiphar. In chapter 40, that will result in his being sent to prison totally unfairly, no excuse for it. He was lied about, and in his innocence, still finds himself behind bars. But in chapter 41, Pharaoh has some dreams. Joseph relates to those dreams, interprets those dreams, and finds himself in what position? Second only to Pharaoh himself, as high as you can go without being the top dog. And then, he sure gives his brothers a hard time. In fact, I always love reading these stories about how he treats them. Found that fascinating all my life. But, you know, nonetheless, it'll work out in the end. Joseph will meet his brother Benjamin through his shenanigans there. He is able to play the hand in such a manner that he is going to get to see the brother. So long lost, it was back home. Chapter 44, he's going to continue giving his brothers a hard time, testing them. Chapter 45, he will finally reveal himself to his brothers and reconcile with his brothers. Now you notice here in my outline that I've now put it in red. Jacob comes back into this. And so I'm calling this, you know, Joseph's outline, and Joseph is the principal player. But Jacob, his father, is still figuring rather highly in these events, and God needed to get him out of that land, you know, to join Joseph in Egypt, save his life in so doing. In chapter 47, Joseph will save not just his family, but all of Egypt, due to the visions we'll talk about in a minute. Chapter 48, Jacob blesses Joseph's sons, and then in 49, just before he dies, immediately before he passes away, apparently with his last strength, he will foretell the future. Each of these sons will be told what will take place years down the road for their descendants. The tribal future is being foretold in the form of these blessings. And finally in chapter 50, Jacob, actually in the last verse of chapter 49, will die. And then Joseph also will die. And what will both of them want, ultimately? For them to be buried where? Back home in the family cemetery, which is the cave of Machpelah, which he bought from Ephron the Hittite. Okay, so for several generations now, that is Abraham's family tomb. And they're finding their way back there. They want to be buried in the promised land, the land that had been promised to them first in what chapter of Genesis? Get out. 12. Well, I mean, I see the argument, but chapter 12 to Abraham. So when Abraham came on the scene, this series of promises then began. Okay, now, tonight I had a little bit of a problem, and as I'm looking at this, I thought, there are some things that are of a similar nature, which are interspersed throughout these chapters 37 through 50. So tonight, I'm not just simply going to do as I have in the preceding classes, you know, page by page, straight through. So in each of these slides, though, I'll tell you where we'll be reading, and then we'll skip around a little bit to work by subject matter rather than the strictest chronology here, but I think you'll see why in just a minute. So I'd like to ask everybody then, please, turn to page 51. In page 51, you'll be looking at chapter 37 of Genesis. In Genesis chapter 37, we want to read about the very first of Joseph's dreams. And the very first time then, that he's just going to have a whole lot of trouble because God has chosen him to be a prophet. What we're learning very early on is that when God chooses somebody to be his special servant somehow, is it all just peaches and cream and bowls of cherries and ways strewn with roses? No. And these men will pay quite a price for being God's chosen people. This, in fact, is going to become a theme for the entire Bible. We'll certainly see it played out with the Lord himself, the apostles, and the others you know, in the first century. It's the way the world works. And as the Lord's servants said, we just have to prepare ourselves for that, expect that. It's often enough. You're swimming upstream in the world. You're striving to be pure and righteous and holy, in a humble servant of God in the middle of a world that is anything but pure, righteous, or holy, and got no use for God, you know, serving itself. Now, here comes then the first of these dreams. We're on page 51. We're going to be reading Genesis chapter 37, verses 5 through 8, which is in the left-hand column. This particular book, of course, the New King James Version, fine translation. So in 37:5, Joseph had a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. Why did they hate him already? He was the favored son, which was being flaunted every single day. How? In the coat of many colors, that famous coat. So, now in verse 6, he said to them, "Please hear this dream which I have dreamed. There we were, binding sheaves in the field. Then, behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. And indeed, your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf." Now, as you just look at those words before we read the response there, it's pretty apparent that you know how many sheaves are there, isn't it? There's a sheaf that belongs to Joseph. He's out there with his brothers, and they each have a sheaf. And what does all their labor that's resulted in this collection of this odor, wheat, or barley, or whatever it was, but, you know, they've gathered it up, they've bound it in some manner, as you see here in this artist's depiction, and then very clearly, what are 11 sheaves doing? They're bowing down. Okay? Now, let me just ask, what did each sheaf represent? It represented a tribal representative, which is currently living, each of the 11 sons of Jacob. So, there's a sheaf per what? Per man. How many sheaves are there? 12 altogether, 11 that are bowing. Okay? Now, don't answer the question, just kind of tuck it away. What is the symbolic meaning of the term 11? What does that number represent? Well, in this passage, what does it represent? Nothing beyond the fact that there's one for each guy, right? So in this case, what does 11 mean? It means 11. Okay, that's what it means. Okay, yes. Pardon me? Oh, good for you. See, that's the problem with black students. They're always correcting the teacher. Great. Thank you. So at any rate, each sheaf represents a very specific thing, doesn't it? And the number means what the number is. Okay? Now, let's look at the next one. I also on page 51, and, I guess I forgot to read verse 8, didn't I? His brother said to him, "Shall you indeed reign over us? Shall you indeed have dominion over us?" What did they get out of the dream? Yeah, mad. But did they understand it? No, I think they understood it right well. They knew exactly what it meant. It meant Joseph was going to have some sort of power, authority, grace, blessing. You know, somehow they were going to be in a position of subservience or obeisance and paying homage, you know, to him. They immediately got it, and it riled them up. Now, let's go to page... Now, were they wrong? Well, they're absolutely right. Now, page 51, again, we'll start with 9 and 10 now. We'll finish there too, I guess. But he dreamed still another dream. He told it to his brothers. He said, "Look, I've dreamed another dream. And this time, the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me." So he told it to his father and his brothers. His father did what? Rebuked him. What is this dream you've dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you? Now, did he misinterpret the dream? No. And what did the number mean? What the number says. Numerical value is its meaning. Okay? And then sun and moon are set forth, they're different than stars. But immediately, what does Daddy know? You're talking about the family here. Okay? So there's one sun, there's one moon, and those are Papa and Mom. Okay? And then the sun. What's the deal? Okay? So, now let's go to page 55. I just want to run the thread on these visions. These are our first visions, aren't they? And these are symbolic visions. They're not just God says this will happen. They are symbolic representations of something. In page 55, we're going to be reading now from Genesis chapter 40, verses 12 and 13, which you'll find on 55 in the left-hand column. They're about the middle. So, Genesis 40, verse 12. Joseph said to him, this is the interpretation of it. Now, we're in prison. We got the butler and the baker now. And so, these two prisoners have told him the dream. I'm just reading the interpretation. This is the interpretation of it. The three branches are what? 3 days. What did three represent? 3 days. And then Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your place, and you will put Pharaoh's cup in his hand according to the former manner when you were his butler. So in this third of symbolic visions that are presented here in the book of Genesis, we are given to understand that three means what? Three. And in this case, would there be any way on earth that anybody would know? And now it would help here, I guess, if we went back and looked at verse 12. Joseph said to him, this is the interpretation of it. The three what are 3 days? Branches. How could any human being know that a branch is a day? You can't. That is not possible. They all understood three means three. The numerical value was unchanging, and it didn't represent something else. It meant three. But the part that needed to be interpreted was the branch. What does the branch represent? A day. And ultimately, what did it mean, the entire interpretation? Good news, you're getting out of jail. And you're going to have your old job back, too. That's real good news. Now let's go to page 55 again, skipping down to verse 18, which would be there toward the bottom of that left-hand column. Now we're going to hear from the baker. So Joseph answered and said, this is the interpretation of his dream. The three baskets are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift off your head from you and hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat your flesh from you. So symbolically, what does 3 mean as opposed to 11? What is the symbolic representation of the number? What bigger idea does that encompass? And the answer is nothing. It means 3. But now in this story, we have not branches, but we still have days, don't we? And how could you know that? You can't. You need an interpreter to tell you that. So now, in 3 days, what's going to happen to this poor guy? He's dead and gone. Okay? And of course, these dreams come true. Now, turn to page 56. Page 56, go to Genesis chapter 41. And in Genesis 41, I'm going to start the reading there at verse 25. You see, it's not a real long reading, but a little longer than some. So we're on page 56, right-hand side there, down toward the bottom there, the last full paragraph. Joseph said to Pharaoh, now once again, you know the story, I'm not reading the original dream, I'm just reading the interpretation. The dreams of Pharaoh are one. He'd had two, they mean the same thing. God has shown Pharaoh what he's about to do. the seven good cows are what? Okay, now, as opposed to 3 or 11, what does 7 mean? It means 7. Okay. It holds a numerical value, and what else? Well, nothing else. 7 years in this case. And the seven good heads are 7 years. The dreams are once. So whether it's cows or heads, 7 means 7 and will correspond to a year. The 7 thin and ugly cows which came up after them are 7 years. The 7 empty heads blighted by the east wind are 7 years of famine. This is the thing which I have spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. Indeed, 7 years of great plenty will come throughout all the land of Egypt. But after them, 7 years of famine will arise, and all the plenty will be forgotten in the land of Egypt, and the famine will deplete the land. So the plenty will not be known in the land because of the famine following it, for it will be very severe. And the dream was repeated to Pharaoh twice because the thing is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass. Now, how many thousands of years would it be before that came to pass? 7 years, wouldn't it? Okay? Now, you know why I bring it up. Just a week ago, Tuesday, I was with the Seventh-day Adventist, and I took a few minutes. I said, guys, you know, just to tease you a little bit, and, you know, set the stage for maybe some future studies. Remember, we got 3 Seventh-day Adventist preachers in town at the table with me, and I read those first 3 verses of Revelation 1:1-3. And twice, in the first 3 verses, what does Revelation say? These things will shortly come to pass. Then I went to the end of the book, chapter 22, and I read chapter 22, verse 6, verse 10, 11, 12, and clear down to 21. I think there's half a dozen times that it says exactly the same thing. These things are near. They will come to pass quickly. We have time terms that begin the book and end the book. But as I was reading to the Adventists, I said, gentlemen, look carefully at your Bible, and I set them up real good. What translation do you have? And he told me, okay, what translation do you have? Okay, what translation do you have? You know, I said, okay, now you guys stare at the page. I'm going to read from the New American Standard. And each time I came to the an expression that said near or shortly or quickly, instead I read it out loud, 2,000 years, a couple of millenniums, you know, I 50 generations. I put these other terms in because for a Seventh-day Adventist, what is the book all about? Anything in the past? Nothing in the past. Anything that would shortly come to pass for the people that were handed the book? Nothing. What do they think that Revelation is all about? Events that are in our future. But what the book says. Isn't it interesting that we have our first symbolic visions in the first book of the Bible? And then what do we have in the last book? A whole lot of symbolic visions. Okay? In the first book, what did the numbers represent? Numbers. And if you had an object, whether it was, you know, bread or wine or branches or wood, cows, you know, barley. See, then we are told what that thing represented. But numerically, did any number have attached to it any significance larger, smaller, or different than its own numerical value? None. It had none. So, I'm not going to get into Revelation and all of that, but for those of you who have been through my class, you'll notice that I spend a lot of time in that in Revelation. And what I teach is, we ought to read every word in the Bible first by its most basic definition. And if there's something in the context that's going to require that that word be symbolic or figurative and represent something else, then how are we going to know that? There'll be something in the context that would suggest it. And we need to be very careful, because it would be very easy to start assigning ideas to these symbols that maybe don't belong there. And we certainly don't want to be caught up in the same mistakes that the Seventh-day Adventists and Jehovah's Witnesses, all, you know, most of the Protestant world today, with the Left Behind series and Hal Lindsey's Late Great Planet Earth and all of that. There's not a word of truth in any of that. And it is all founded on the primary principle that the book of Revelation cannot mean what it says when it says these things are shortly to come to pass. It cannot mean that. I think it does. And I get that for the same reason I did out of this last statement in Genesis chapter 41 at the top of page 57 in verse 32. Genesis 41, 32. The dream was repeated to Pharaoh twice because the thing is established by God and God will shortly bring it to pass. Do you ever repeat something for emphasis? Yeah, sometimes do too. So you got. What was he doing with the number two? Impressing Pharaoh with the certainty of what? The same single thing that these both different visions represented. So, I'm not taking much time to go to Revelation or anything else, but just, I think it would be wise for us, with the very first visions that we are given, and they're interpreted for us, to at least tuck away in our minds just maybe further visions that originate in God in symbolic terminology might be understood in the same way. At least, let's try that, you know, before we assign other ideas to it. Now, everybody, back to page 51, and we're going to change the topic entirely. I just wanted to collect all the visions out of chapters 37 and following. Now let's go to page 51 and 52, and we're going to read chapter 37 of Genesis, verses 21 through 24. So there in the right-hand column, real close to the bottom, Genesis 37, 21, Reuben heard, and he delivered him, which would be Joseph, out of their hands and said, let us not kill him. And Reuben said to them, shed no blood, but cast him into this pit, which is in the wilderness. Do not lay a hand on him. That, now we're getting a parenthetical statement so we know what was in his mind, that he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father. So when Joseph is now reaping the wrath of his brothers because they full well understood what those visions meant, and they sure didn't care for it either, him being the youngest and all, or next two. So now Reuben is the one of the brothers that what? He's showing some kind, you know, of sense and compassion and fear. You know, and in the midst of this mob, you know, let's kill him. He's the one that's a little bit rational at least, and yet apparently out of fear for the others, he's not willing to just stand there and fight them off. You know, this entire thing is wrong, but he tries a little bit of subterfuge here to see if he can rescue later poor Joseph from out of the pit. So, where did I stop the reading there? 23. So it came to pass, when Joseph had come to his brothers, that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, that one of many colors that was on him. They took him and cast him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it, but he couldn't get out of it. And so it maybe well or was a dry well, which would be extremely difficult, you know, to climb back out of. And now, skipping 25, just look at 26, which would be there on the top of page 52, right at the top. So Judah said to his brothers, what profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hands be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh. So Reuben, from the outset, you know, was at least a little bit rational. Judah seems to have caught the spirit a little bit, didn't he? Good for him. So, okay, but let's sell him. Let's make a profit. So it wasn't exactly like he was altogether altruistic either. And so we'll sell him to the Ishmaelites, and he is our brother, our flesh. His brothers listened. The Midianite traders passed by, so the brothers pulled Joseph up, lifted him out of the pit, sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and took Joseph off to Egypt. Can you imagine the scene where these brothers come back and lie to their father, all of them, that he's dead and killed by a wild animal, because we found this. Is there a word of truth in what they're telling you? No. And to conspire like this. Now, you know, I was almost going to ask, raise your hand if you think that you were the favored child, that you might have a brother or sister in the room. Okay. Look, if that's the case, even if that's the case, and it'd make you feel terrible, could it possibly justify you this? Yeah, there's a kind of a comeuppance going on here, isn't there? Okay, but was his behavior justifiable either? You don't really know. And so we're watching these amazing events that are taking place, and the hardness of their hearts, and just the evil and the darkness that's going on right here. And you would think that if this is all just myth and fable that's being made up because we're the chosen people, so we're better than everybody else, would there be stories like this? Not hardly. So here we go, warts and all again, with the biblical record not being fancified and dressed up and excused, but just simply related in all of its ugliness, because that was the truth of the matter. Now, in Genesis 37, and skip a verse again, come down to verse 26 now. In 26, I just read that, didn't I? I've got both of those. All right, so now in 38, what do we have? More works. And again, you know, really ugly ones. So I'm going to spend the time here. You did the reading again. But now just the end result of it, brethren, maybe you've wondered, why this story? What for? What's the positive lesson? You know, what is it? Look at this, in the first verse in the top of the right-hand column on page 53, you have Genesis 38:28. So it was when she was giving birth that the one, remember she got twins also, put out his hand, midwife took a scarlet thread, bound it on his hand, saying, this one came out first. Then it happened as he drew back his hand, his brother came out unexpectedly, and she said, how'd you break through this breach? Be upon you. Therefore, his name was called Perez, which won't be hard to figure out. What does Perez mean? Breach. Afterward, his brother came out who had a scarlet thread on his hand. His name is called Zerah. Okay, what's chapter 38 about?
I don't know.
Okay, well, Zerah, not going to hear from him again. What about Perez? Does that name ring a bell for you? Through his lineage, long time from now, who will come? Jesus the Christ. We are still tracing those genealogies, warts and all, but Perez is going to be found in Matthew chapter 1, verse 3, in Matthew's genealogy of the Christ. He will also be found in Luke 3, verse 33, in Luke's genealogy of the Christ. You might jot that down in your Bibles, whether this one or your regular Bible, but there right at the end of chapter 38, usually you have a blank line of some kind. You know, just put Perez in Jesus' genealogy, Matthew 1, 3, Luke 3, 33. A lot of threes in there. Matthew 1, 3, Luke 3, 33. Okay? So, we still are maintaining God's interest in family lines that will be a part of the prophetic proof that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. He has to come through that line and none other, because this is the promise. Now then, Perez is in Jesus' genealogy. I guess I already did that. I just didn't put it on the screen. Okay. Now, Genesis chapter 39. And again, I'm going to go now by subject matter rather than the chronological order. So we're backing up a couple of chapters now. We're coming back to chapter 39. Let's read in the right-hand column there, verses 2 through 6. So Joseph is a slave in Egypt. Verse 2, Genesis 39:2, the Lord was with Joseph. And he was a successful man. He was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. How successful does that sound? Slave, sold by his brothers into a foreign land. But he's successful. And his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made all he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. Sometimes we might think those are almost the opposites. He has favor in his master's sight. Yes. But what did the Scripture take careful pains to tell us right at the end there? Verse 4, last three words. And served him. There is success in his what? In his service. Service, we are learning, is not necessarily a bad thing. Service is not necessarily a punishment. Service is slavery is not necessarily proof positive that you're some great sinner. He is prospering in his innocence and serving both God and his human master. It's the middle of verse 4. Then he made him overseer of his house. And all that he had he put under his authority. Verse 5. So it was, from the time he had made him overseer of his house, and all that he had, that the Lord blessed whose house? The Egyptian's house. For whose sake? Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house. Who'd the house belong to? Potiphar. And in the field. Whose field was it? Who's getting all the blessing? Well, Potiphar is. He's making all the money. But where's the blessing coming from? Joseph's service. Thus, he left all that he had in Joseph's hand. He did not know what he had except for the bread which he ate. How much did he trust Joseph? He quit even giving in to king. Now, how did he get this guy? He bought him in a slave market. And he has come to have so much confidence that he has turned over to him everything he has. And now he's like, look at his books. My, how we could strive for that. To have a reputation that is so sterling. That one who ought, in the natural order of things, really be suspicious and watch it like an eagle and distrusting everything. Because most often, if history is any lesson, what are slaves frequently like? There's a lot of tilting that goes on, a lot of slacking off that goes on, you know, there's a lot of stuff that goes on. But a wholehearted service to the point that your master would say, well, I don't even need to look at the books anymore. That's how much I trust you. That's quite a standard to aspire to, isn't it? Now, certainly, when we come to our New Testament, we watch all the history of the Old. Who are we in the sight of our God? Lords and kings?
Servants.
We're servants. And the term for slavery is used. Is that demeaning? Is that humiliating? Is that some sort of put-down? Not necessarily at all. And in the service of our king, were we to give ourselves into the service as faithfully as Joseph did, well then, Joseph can do it. Can I do it? Sure. Now, will God know that I have served him faithfully and well? Yes. Will we all be rewarded in due time?
Yes.
Certainly. Might we also be rewarded in quick time? Yeah, I could. Maybe, maybe not. Not guaranteed. But when you look at the story, what do you learn about service? All your heart, all your soul, all your mind. Okay? Go to it. And its success is attributed to that. Now I'll come to Genesis 39, skip down to verse 21, which will be over on page 54, and there in the right-hand column, a little bit tough to find in the middle of that last paragraph in that chapter, but in 39:21, the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy. Now, you'll remember, where is he now? Is he still in Potiphar's house? Well, now he's in prison because he served so faithfully, the wife lied about him, and he winds up in jail. Well, who's with him? God is with him. Now, where is he? He's in jail. What is God also showing him? Mercy. God is showing him mercy where? In jail. And he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever they did there, it was his doing. The keeper of the prison did not look into anything that was under Joseph's authority, because the Lord was with him in whatever he did, who made it prosper. So now, totally different environment. Both environments that Joseph found himself in were due to gross evil, injustice, and sin that had been perpetrated against him. Does he appear to have much of a chip on his shoulder? How does he serve his God? Does he do it reluctantly and blaming him all the time and wondering why me and this isn't fair? No, how does he do? He serves those people with such fervor that in both cases, and one of them is a jail and he's a prisoner, what does the keeper do? Not even have to worry about me. Okay? Recently we had this jail escape. Apparently no Joseph's in there. Okay. Quite a mess. Okay. Was anybody going to escape on Joseph's watch?
No.
No, they're not going to be any escapes either. Now, if you surrender the whole prison to him, could there have been some?
Yeah.
Sure could have been. Including whose?
Yes.
He takes no such liberties with this authority. He is a what? Slave at first, and then a jailbird. Okay? And in both cases, what is he? He is the best slave you ever saw. And then he is the best prisoner you ever saw. And all of this that comes to him is God's mercy and favor coming from these other parties is due exclusively in the stories to Joseph's what? Raise your hand if you've got to go to work tomorrow. School.
That's so rude.
Come on, work. Have you got parents? Whenever you are in a position of subservience, who has become for all time the standard by which you serve? How you learn to discipline and bridle yourself. How you learn to submit. How you learn to yield to another's will. Who is the preeminent example? Awesome, isn't it? And you try to put yourself in his shoes and think, could I get halfway to what this guy was able to accomplish? Well, we know those stories. He winds up, thirdly, where? Second to Pharaoh. How had he served Pharaoh? Exactly the same way. So he interpreted the dream first. Boom, he got quite a promotion. And then, you know, he serves Pharaoh absolutely faithfully. Ultimately, of course you know the story, but ultimately, betrayed by his brother, sold into slavery. Okay? Terrible lie that accuses him of the grossest form of immorality, and now he finds himself not a slave, but a prisoner. And then, he's interpreting dreams, and the next thing you know, he's second in command over all Egypt. And whose lives will be spared as a result? His brothers who put him there, and his mother, and his dad, you know, the family. I can't remember now if the mother was still living when, I guess he was not, okay? And so, you know, he rescues not just the family, but what? The whole nation through whom will come Christ, the Son of the Living God. Well, this is why we teach the story to our kids. We try to help them to understand that this is not something, you know, to kick against the goads, as, you know, the Lord asked Paul, you know, why he was doing it. This is the thing that you learn from. And so throughout your lives, when you get hit with stuff, the last question you should be asking is, why me? The last thought you should be thinking is, this is unfair, this is unjust. If Joseph is any example, what should we take for granted? The world is
unfair.
Duh. Now what am I to do about it? Serve in the capacity I find myself to such an extent that I am the most trusted person in sight. That's how it's supposed to be. Okay. Now, as you heard the bell, you know, we've just got a minute or two. So I'm leaving off this whole story about Joseph and his brothers. It's a very tangled thing. It goes on for chapters. He's really manipulating them. Through it all, he is tormenting them. And as he does, he really puts them through some hoops and the money in the sack, you know, and go bring your brother and all this stuff. You know, but all of that, was it just mean? Have you learned anything about Joseph that would make you think he was just being mean? No. So there must be something that he's trying to accomplish here. Now, what do we know about the brothers' relationship and desires from Joseph at the end of the way he treated them? What do they want? They want on one thing. What is it, Bill?
What
forgiveness is the word I'm looking for, but you're right. Forgive us, don't kill us, and then the Father, certainly, you know, care for the Father, but it's forgiveness that they keep asking for. Okay? Now, he put them through some really tough stuff, but if you remember the forgiveness while you're looking, and you see how desperately they want reconciliation, okay? He had put them through all these hoops, and in so doing, what had he taught them? That they were completely at his mercy. So what did they plead for?
Mercy.
And what did they get? Was it heartfelt? I think they'd figured it out. Well, hey, Carol got to be here, Ron will come to you.
Well, he also got them think about what they did, and he was able to judge their hearts and their position. So he knew how they felt about it, and they knew that he knew that they couldn't, I think some of them couldn't do that to their father again.
Carol brought an outstanding point. Joseph learned about their characters, didn't he? He was able to verify that, you know, there was sincerity there. Okay, Ron?
They feared him, though, all their lives. Up until the time Jacob passed away, he said, okay, he's going to take revenge on us now. He's going to get us. It never came to pass, but that was a fear in the back of their mind all their lives.
This is true. And so what did Joseph then prove at that time? Same thing. His mercy was real. His forgiveness was complete and absolutely true. That's the word I want. And so, in the end, have all these people really learned something? Okay? Now, Genesis just ended. Took us 4 weeks to do Genesis. We saw, as a central character, Noah. What's the story of Noah? Serve God and save your life and that of your family. We got Abraham, and what do we find? Obey me, leave Ur of the Chaldees, go where I tell you. And what happened? We had quite a lot of adventures, but where did he wind up? In the promised land, just like God told him. And these promises come to him now about people that are going to come forth from him, and there'll be as many as the stars and sand, and there's going to be a whole raft of promises that are going to come. And so now we start down the genealogies, and we come to Jacob, and we see all kinds of shenanigans and foolishness and craziness and sin. What do we also see? Can God work his plan in it all? Stealing birthright and crossing hands and all the rest, but when it goes down, is it God's will or man's? God's will. Okay? And then we come to Joseph, and we see a man who's never been, nobody's been mistreated as bad as Joseph just ever. Okay? Now, if you were to ask Joseph at the end of his life, would you do it all again? What do you suppose he would say? Well, I saved my whole family and the chosen people of God, the entire nation. And now the promises can continue, because this crisis could have meant the undoing of everything that would lead to the cross. No, I'll do it again. Now, I'll leave with this thought. I heard the bell, but I just want to close, everybody. Come over to Genesis 50. It just popped into my mind. I'm not even sure I can find it now, but in Genesis 50, I think it's right down toward the end here, if I can just find it. Here it is in Genesis 50 in verse 19. Let's close with this. Joseph said to them, as Ron just pointed out right at the end, Jacob's dead, "Do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God? But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good." That's the second time he has said that in this book. So let's all go home and remember that thought. When evil comes your way, these people may mean it for evil, but this evil thing that they mean to do to you may actually be what? Best thing that ever could happen. You may not know, even in this life, how great that is that they just did that to you. Okay?